So the electromagnetic field is described by electric and magnetic fields. And the field equations are Maxwell's equations. So they are written in terms of, so it's convenient, as I hope you know, to introduce a field tensor. Whose components are electric and magnetic fields. So this really forms a tensor. So the various components transform through each other under Lorentz transformations. And Maxwell's equations can be written in a manifestly covariant form with the help of this tensor. So actually, there are two equations which this tensor satisfies. So there is a first type of equations, and then there is a second type of Maxwell's equations. And so they describe completely the how field depends on x and t. So suppose you have some boundary conditions for these equations. For reasonable boundary conditions, they will have a unique solution. So they describe the electromagnetic field depending on. Okay, so how? So they completely describe the field. However, and the field, of course, characterized completely by giving B and D as functions of X and T, or specifying the value of the field tensor. However, this tensor itself, or E and B, cannot be considered as the basic dynamical variables. So it's impossible to write down these equations as they stand. They do not follow from variation of any action of Lagrangian. So the variational problem for them is impossible to formulate. And it is known how to fix this problem. One introduces electromagnetic potentials. Which form a four vector with components whose zeros component is the scalar potential, usual potential of electric field, and the vector potential is the minus sign is the special component of the four potential. Okay, and then electric and magnetic fields are expressed through potentials by taking derivatives. So the field tensor is anti-symmetric and is given by this formula. Now, just from this representation, So the second Maxwell's equations becomes an identity if you substitute F in this form. And the first equation is an equation for A. So one can write it as d squared A mu minus d mu d nu nu is equal to 0. So this is the first equation. However, this description in terms of potential contains some ambiguities. Namely, we can shift the potential by any gradient. So if you substitute this in the definition of the field tensor, then we'll see that the gradient term cancels. So F mu remains unchanged. These transformations are called gauge transformations. Or gradient transformations. And they show that potentials themselves are not physical quantities, so they are only defined up to gradients of some scalar function. So there is an intrinsic ambiguity in this description of an electromagnetic field in terms of potentials. Yes?
Is there any constraint on the kind of function that you might have to
be? Depending on boundary conditions, there will be constraints. If you impose boundary conditions, then this function should also satisfy some boundary conditions, et cetera, et cetera. I'll not specify that at the moment. So one may wonder if these potentials play any role, as they are not directly observable quantities. They are defined up to gradients. So the reason that it is convenient to introduce them is that then the Maxwell's equations can be formulated in terms of the dynamical system that follows from varying the action. So the Lagrangian density of the electromagnetic field is simply F mu squared. So if you write this in components, this will be equal to electric field squared minus magnetic field squared. So in some sense, electric field squared is the kinetic energy, and magnetic field squared is potential energy. But anyway, so the varying this direction corresponding to this Lagrangian, one gets Maxwell's equations in the vacuum. So the since the action depends only on electric and magnetic fields, on F mu, and F mu don't change under gauge transformations, this Lagrangian is gauge invariant. So this transformation can be regarded as a symmetry of the Lagrangian. Now, this is not the same type of symmetry that we studied before. Depends on the continuous parameter, so omega can be basically arbitrary function. However, the parameter of transformation is allowed to depend on x and on t. So unlike transformations that we studied before, this transformation is local. So gauge invariants is a local symmetry in the sense that the parameter of transformation is an arbitrary function of space-time coordinates. So as opposed to other types of symmetries that are usually called global symmetries. So for instance, Lorentz symmetry is a global symmetry. So Lorentz symmetry is a global symmetry in the sense that the parameter of Lorentz transformation is the same in all space-time, right? So we, for instance, we rotate our reference frame by rotated by the same angle everywhere. So there is a physical distinction between these two types of symmetries. In particular, it doesn't make much sense to apply Noether theorem to this, to the gauge symmetry. What you will discover is that the current that you derive from Noether symmetry is identically equal to zero in the equations of motion. In fact, the left-hand side of Maxwell's equations is the Noether current of gauge symmetry. So in the equations of motion simply tell us that this current is equal to zero. Okay, so, on the other hand, we have the action and the dynamical variables here are potentials. So the Maxwell's equations are derived by varying the action with respect to potentials. So then we can try to quantize this system, so we can, well, can try to apply canonical analysis to the Maxwell's action, which turns out to be a really complicated task because of the gauge invariance. So to illustrate, so one illustration of that is that if you try to define canonical momenta, canonical momenta are derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to time derivatives of the fields, you'll see that the canonical momenta conjugate to a zero is equal to zero. So the Lagrangian does not contain time derivatives of a zero. Which is, can be seen from the definition, because you see, the derivative and the Lorentz index on the derivative and on the potential must be different because F mu nu is anti-symmetric. So a zero dot never appears anywhere in the Lagrangian. So this means that A0 is not really a dynamical variable. We cannot define the conjugate momentum. It is rather a, so the correct interpretation is that this Lagrange, that it is a Lagrange multiplier of some constraint that we should impose on the system. So it's not really, so Maxwell's equations are not all of them are dynamical equations, so part of them should be interpreted as constraints. And so this brings in certain complications. In fact, if you look in the textbooks, the quantization of the electromagnetic field is the most complicated subject in any introductory text of quantum field theory. Some books, in particular our textbook that we use in this course, by Peskin and Schroeder, they simply omit this subject in the first reading. So they postpone quantization of electromagnetic field till later when you learn path integrals and their quantization. So there are other methods to quantize field theory. And it is only these methods where quantization becomes simple. Otherwise, it's just incomprehensible. One has to deal with the states with indefinite Hilbert spaces, with indefinite metric, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll also not do an honest quantization of electromagnetic field. Instead, provide some plausibility arguments and just write the answer. So the idea is that, again, we just find the most general solution of the Maxwell's equations and then promote amplitudes to creation and annihilation operators. However, even solving the Maxwell's equations, in terms of potentials, so it's not a well-posed problem because of the gauge invariance, right? So yes. No, that's just impossible. Yes. Any reason why it is impossible? I don't remember why, but I don't remember why. It has something to do with this equation, so this is not really a dynamical equation. It's rather, so here it's just an identity, because when we write F in terms of potentials, this is satisfied identically. Otherwise, it's very difficult to write it down as coming out of some Lagrangian. Anyway, so there is an ambiguity. Any solutions can be gauge transformed, so we can change a solution by an arbitrary function of space and time coordinates, and this is not good. We want to figure out how to characterize the field without ambiguities, because any physical quantity is only sensitive to the values of A and B or to F mu, and so all gauge equivalent field configurations are physically equivalent. So we better pick just one representative in the class of the equivalence class field configurations. Sometimes it's called the gauge orbit. So we have, in the space of all fields, we have an orbit that of fields that field configurations related by gauge transformations, and they actually should be considered as one point, as one solution, so solution of Maxwell's equations. So how to achieve that? We should impose a gauge condition. So we should impose some condition on the potentials, some function of potentials is equal to zero, such that um, for any A mu, there exists, and in principle we should require that it's also unique, gauge transformation that that makes this condition true. So one can picture this as follows. So we have, so this is our field space. So the space of all possible gauge potentials, it is foliated into gauge orbits, right? So we can do gauge transformations, which change the value of fields, but we should consider all fields in the orbit to be physically equivalent, right? So the gauge condition picks up some curve in the field space that is transverse to all orbits. So in each orbit we have only one point where this condition is satisfied. So this is the point where G of A is zero. So this is just a way to characterize uniquely each physically equivalent gauge configuration. Yes? Sorry?
Do you write gauge orbits?
Gauge orbits.
What does that mean?
So gauge orbit is a collection of all fields. For all omega. So I don't know if you can picture this. This is an infinite dimensional space of all possible fields, all possible functions. And in this field, in this space of fields, we pick up an orbit of gauge transformation. So for any point here is characterized by omega. So we get gradient of omega to our field, and so this moves us around this gauge orbit.
So each of the circles is the set of all potentials that are equivalent up to gauge transformation.
Yes. Yes, and so they are physically, so the fields here are physically equivalent, so we want to pick up one point in each equivalence class. And that we can do by imposing a gauge condition. Question? So, what this gauge condition is?
I have one more question.
Yes.
The condition is point by point. You have to go point by point space between the gauge.
Or? Not necessarily. I mean, this is, so this is space of functions. So the condition is a functional, right? So it's some functional that has the property that it turns to zero once on each gauge orbit. Now, what is this functional? Well, that's in our hands. We can. There are many possible choices. So let me give a few examples. So, different gauges are useful in different physical applications. So one possible gauge is the temporal gauge. Where we pick a field, a component which is A0 and set it to 0. Okay. So how does it work? Well, we need to check that for any field configuration, this condition can be satisfied once on each order. So we need to check. So suppose that we are that A mu is given, but does not satisfy this condition. We want the gauge transformer and get a zero. Well, this is an equation for omega which has basically a unique solution, which is minus integral of d of a zero. So it has a unique solution in terms of omega. You can always bring any configuration into this gauge by gauge transforming with this particular omega. So it's indeed it's a gauge condition. So this allows us to get rid of a zero, which was a troublesome field that didn't have its it enters the action without time derivatives. So, but we can get rid of it by just by imposing the gauge. So in this sense, this gauge is useful, and it is this gauge which is the starting point of consistent canonical analysis of the electromagnetic field. But for other practical purposes, it's not very good because it breaks Lorentz invariance. So we set to zero the time component of the gauge potentials, and this is certainly not invariant under Lorentz transformations. There is another gauge condition that we will use. So we will use the condition that's called the Lorentz gauge. Which says that d mu a mu is equal to zero. Now, strictly speaking, this gauge condition doesn't. There is a residual gauge freedom. It doesn't fix the gauge completely. Namely, if we do a gauge transformation. Such that the gauge function is satisfies the wave equation, then you see that this gauge, this equation doesn't change. So we can still do some sort of gauge transformations. However, if we pose, yes?
With that chi right over there.
What is there a chi? It should be on there. However, if we impose correct boundary conditions, we can eliminate this, so this will not have any solutions on these prescribed boundary conditions. Anyway, so apart from this little residual freedom, this gauge eliminates this redefinition ambiguity in gauge potentials, and then we can solve Maxwell's equations and find the unique solution in this gauge. So the Maxwell's equations for potentials uh, become just a set of four Klein-Gordon equations. And so the solution is just the same as the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, but for four components. So we can write it down immediately. Write that A mu of x is equal to some Fourier integral. Always a danger of using LaTeX and pasting and copying, so this equation and notes is not correct, but there is no mass. Okay, I already now write daggers here. So this dagger for the classical field, it's just denotes complex conjugation, but later I'll promote these amplitudes to creation manipulation operators. Okay, so I wrote it in this form, introducing some polarization vectors. So far, epsilon mu, yes?
There should be a theta inside, shouldn't there?
No. There should be a theta, that's right. Yes. So these amplitudes, so they tell you how much the electromagnetic field is fluctuated in space-time. And the polarization vectors show in which directions they fluctuate. Because this contains, the Fourier expansion contains only modes with p squared equals zero, the Maxwell's equation will be automatically satisfied because this is just a condition that p squared is equal to zero for all Fourier modes. But we also need to impose the gauge condition. So the Lorentz condition should be imposed on this solution. In momentum space, this condition is very simple. In momentum space, this means that so D becomes IP. So this means that the potentials have to be transverse, should be perpendicular to the momentum. So polarization should be perpendicular to the momentum. So this is one condition for four components. So we have potentially we have four possible polarizations. However, Well, we know that light has only two polarizations. So how does it come out of this analysis? So one polarization is removed by this condition. It is convenient to, well, draw a picture. So suppose that this is the wave vector. And then let's choose two vectors that form a basis in three-dimensional space. So these are vectors E1 and E2, which are perpendicular to the direction of propagation of the electromagnetic wave. So, yes?
Yeah.
What is theta? Mm-hmm. Theta is the step function. So it's theta of P0.
And P0 is just the first component.
P0 is the first component of. This is the same expression as for the Klein-Gordon field, but since now we have four components, then we need to introduce this polarization. Okay, so what possible vectors satisfy this Lorentz condition? Well, let's choose three vectors. So there are three solutions. This is one condition for compounds, so there are three solutions. So two of them are transverse polarizations. So they have zero in the time component, and then one or two in the spatial component. So this is perpendicular to the four momentum because, this product is equal to P0 times the zeros component of the polarization minus the scalar product with the spatial component of momentum, but E1 and E2 are chosen such that they are perpendicular to the momentum. And then the third solution is just the momentum itself. Well, this is the solution because the momentum satisfies E mu squared equals to zero. But this polarization is also unphysical because we can remove it using the residual gauge theorem. Indeed, if we look at substitute P mu instead of the polarization vector, we can replace it by derivative in x. And so for this polarization vector, A mu is equal to the gradient of some scalar function. This scalar function will satisfy the condition that d squared chi is equal to zero, because there is a delta function, so this will have some Fourier expansion, etc., etc. So we can use the residual gauge theorem to set the coefficient in front of this polarization vector to an arbitrary number, in particular to zero. Yes.
How can you see from the equations of motion that there must be polarization vectors present?
Well, this is just because A mu has an index. So there are four components of A. We can represent them as projections onto various vectors. So this is just a way to write a four-vector function as a sum of our modes.
see that, I'm not that.
A mu is equal to the derivative of some.
So if I substitute this polarization vector for P for epsilon, so here in this term, P can be replaced by D over by I times D over dx. Okay, and then D over dx can be replaced by half of that for A integral. Okay, so here it can be replaced by minus I D over dx, also taken out of it. So we have D over dx acting on some Fourier integral, which will contain a lot of stuff. But we can set this remaining function to zero altogether, just because it is a harmonic function, so we can remove it by these transformations. So, all in all, we find that the commutative waves have two polarizations, two transverse polarizations. The result that I hope is well known to you. And then we can choose whatever. Arbitrary linear combination of these two polarization vectors. So. Typical choices is linear polarization. So these two vectors correspond to linearly polarized line. Or one can consider as basic vectors the circularly polarized line. And in quantizing the field, it's more convenient to deal with so circular polarization. So we can choose as two remaining vectors complex linear combinations of two transverse vectors. So this corresponds to circularly polarized light. Okay. So now we can just say that the coefficients in front of these elementary solutions of Maxwell's equations are operators that satisfy the commutation relations on the usual form. And that would describe the quantized electromagnetic waves. So indeed, this would create two kinds of particles. These operators describe quanta of light, which are photons. So, and photons can exist in two polarization states. So they can be either they have two helicity states. They their helicity can be either equal to 1 or to minus 1. And so this is more or less the end of the story. So this is how to This is the correct answer for quantization of electromagnetic field. But there are some complications with this picture, so it's not quite completely correct in a sense. The reason for that is again gauge invariance. And basically the gauge condition that we have to impose. So so here when we do classical analysis, we first solve Maxwell's equations, so the equations of motion for the field, and then we imposed the condition, the Lorentz gauge condition as an equation for this solution. So we picked only the solutions that satisfy this extra Lorentz condition. Now when we make A the operator and consider only transverse polarized states here in the Fourier expansion, we in effect impose the Lorentz conditions on the operators. But this is too strong a condition. So in a sense, here we are in the Lorentz gauge. The Lagrangian is just the sum of four copies of Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. And what we do is we quantize independently each component, and then after that impose the Lorentz condition. But if we have four Klein-Gordon fields, and then try to impose this condition on operators, that wouldn't work. So this is too strong a condition. Because this operator does not commute with, say, a nu, so that commutation relations with a nu that would follow from canonical quantization of A mu is four scalar fields would not be equal to zero. Now, it is not very, it's not a good idea to set an operator that doesn't commute with something to zero. So it would be very easily run into contradiction if you try to set something that does not commute to zero, basically because of the uncertainty relation. So as an illustration of this fact, let's consider a toy model where we have a particle moving on the line. With the Hamiltonian p squared over 2m. And suppose that we want to impose the condition p equals to 0. Now, in classical theory, that's okay. This is just a particle at rest. In quantum theory, we cannot set an operator to 0, right? Because it doesn't commute with x. So, we can impose this condition in a weak sense. We can say that we are only interested in the state that has zero eigenvalue of p. So when this state exists, it's just a state with a constant wave, with the constant wave function. So we should do the same here. We should impose the Lorentz condition in a weak sense. So, namely, we should say that our physical states are annihilated by the divergence of A, but we cannot impose it on the operator. So, in principle, in this Fourier expansion, we should keep all the modes, including this non-physical temporal photons and longitudinal photons. But in the physical states, we only the physical states are only composed of photons with transverse polarization. So in practical terms, this doesn't change too much. So we only we still build our Fock space using two oscillators for transverse photons. But when we consider intermediate states in some calculations, then intermediate states can contain these unphysically polarized photons. And in particular, so for intermediate states, we should use the completeness condition. We can use the completeness condition on polarization vectors. Which is not really the case for two polarizations. So this condition tells us that these vectors epsilon mu form a complete basis in our four-dimensional space. So they, if we add time to this picture, then they form the complete basis. So the two vectors don't do that, and only if we sum over all four possible polarizations, we get this equation. Yes?
That you impose traditionally is a weaker condition than that, right? It's just a plus the positive frequency modes which are necessary. The other then follows by the Gupta-Broiler condition actually is just, it's even weaker than that.
Let me think of this.
It's just the positive frequency modes which are usually.
Yes, usually it is that. I think.
Then the Hermitian
that should be equivalent. Because if we don't have any unphysical polar, if unphysical polarizations are not excited,
okay,
then D minus, so A minus annihilates the whole, like the ground, the physical states.
Yeah.
So they should be equivalent. Yes.
I just wanted to check that everyone understood why those things then actually commute. Is it obvious to everybody why the d nu a nu doesn't compute with a nu?
So if you treat, okay, so if you treat this fields as independent Clegg Gordon fields, in particular this contains d0 a0, which is the canonical conjugate field, so it's d0 a0 plus dot dot dot. So, and this is the canonical conjugate to a zero, and so we want to impose the condition that the zero commutes with a nu, which cannot be the case because if nu is zero, then that should be the canonical commutator. So it's there. In some textbooks, one can find simple exercises that prove that this is impossible. There's, it's easy to see that there is a contradiction. Okay, so this is yes.
Like, cut the a mu to half. Like, it would be a mu plus and a mu minus. And then you act with it on the vacuum. So
yes.
A mu minus or plus will automatically be zero, but A mu minus or plus won't be zero, so it would mean that vacuum is not a physical state.
Let me see.
Like A mu is defined like that.
A mu is defined like that. So this would be plus, this A mu minus.
Yes.
Okay.
And if it acts on that cube,
yes.
Won't that other part be zero and other part be something?
Well, the point is that we want this to be satisfied on all states. So this picks up
physical subspace of all of the big Fock space. So there's the Fock space of all four oscillators. So this is not necessarily the vacuum, it may be the state with many, many photons. But the physical states in this subspace are those in which there are no, there should be no transverse, there should be no transverse photons. Yes?
So didn't we say at the beginning that there's a problem with defining the conjugate momentum to?
Yes, that's right. So if you start with the Hamiltonian, so here again, here's the Gaussian invariance is a tricky thing. So first, if you start with the full action of the full Gaussian invariant action, you take a variation, then you find that there is no time derivative of A0. But then if we impose the gauge first, this modifies the action. And then A0 dot reappears in the action. Because basically this comes out from integrating by parts, because we say that mu A mu is 0, so we can always replace gradient of A by minus d 0 a 0. And so in the transformations that bring the action to the form where it's just four Klein-Gordon fields, we use this equation. So this is the consequence of imposing the gauge condition. Yes?
There is actually a problem apparently fine with imposing that. It's too strong a condition.
So you say that one should
be a plus.
Should be?
Yeah. You have to just, yeah.
Just the plus part.
Plus.
Just the plus part.
Why?
Because the positive frequency modes automatically annihilate the vacuum. So if you don't have, if you do that, then if you impose that without a plus sign, even the vacuum state is a physical state.
Even the vacuum state is not a physical state?
I can show you the vacuum
states
a bit.
No, let me see.
Yeah.
Oh, because the minus sign will create some longitudinal states, right? So it will be zero. Yeah, that's true. Yes. So this plus means that that we keep only annihilation operators in the field. Now all this may sound sort of fishy, that we modify this condition, we have to put a plus here, etc., etc. We need to impose the gauge. Well, in practical terms, again, I said from the beginning that I'm not going to quantize the atomic autonomy. So in practical terms, this means that we just use this equation. Expansion and oscillators, and build physical state from transverse photons, and the intermediate state may contain some number of other polarizations. So this is all I wanted to say about photons. And now since we have, so we now know how to quantize the scalar field, the Gordon field, the Dirac field, and the electromagnetic field. But all those fields describe free particles, right? So the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian are just the Fock states of particles. And the energy of the state is sum of the energies of each of the particles. The same is true for spins and charges.
The next big question that we will be trying to understand is what to do when the switch on interacts. And in particular, the theory that we would like to study is quantum electrodynamics, which describes interaction, electromagnetic interactions of electrons and positrons. Now it's very easy to understand how to couple electromagnetic field to the Dirac field, because so this coupling is essentially unique, and that can be understood from various perspectives. So we can start with coupling electromagnetic field to some external current, and we know how to do it. And so we could start with Maxwell's equations with a source on the right hand side, and then hook up some Lagrangian that reproduces these equations of motion by variation, or we can resort to some simple physical reasoning. So what we want to do is to understand interaction of the electromagnetic field with an external current. So current is described by a form vector, which is current form vector. So it's zeroth component is the charge density, and then the special component is the Coulomb flux. So this is the charge density. Now, the energy of charge continuously distributed in space and subject to some potential, some electromagnetic potential, is easy to compute. So if we have static charge distribution without currents, described by density J0, then the energy will be equal to E times J0 times A0, right? Because this is the electric potential. And then we should integrate this over space. So here, E is the charge of electron. The reason that we need to introduce it is that, okay, so later we will consider coupling photons to electrons, and we normalize the charge of electron to be equal to plus one. The physical value of electric charge of electron is some different number, which is by default assumed to be negative. So E will denote the negative charge of the electron. Anyway, so so this is just necessary for correct normalization. So this means that we add to our Lagrangian a term which is equal to minus J0 A0. Because Lagrangian is minus the energy of interaction. So this is basically the potential energy. So it comes with a minus in the Lagrangian density. It is very easy to include magnetic interactions with the magnetic field and currents. So if there are currents in the system, and basically what we can write is the Lorentz invariant generalization of this, we just add the summation over the system. And now we can construct interaction of photons with the Dirac field of electrons and positrons. We just substitute the expression for the current that we derive from Noether's theorem for electrons and positrons, and what we get is this interaction curve. And so this is the electric current of the Dirac field. So this is the most natural interaction of electrons and positrons with the electromagnetic field. So the full Lagrangian that describes electromagnetic interaction of charged particles, so this is the Lagrangian of UEDs. Contains the Lagrangian of electromagnetic field, then the Lagrangian of the Dirac field, and then this interaction term. So this is the theory that we want to study. This completely defines one electrodynamics of electrons and positrons as quantum field theory. In the sense that we know, without this term, we know how to quantize all the fields, and then we can regard this term as a small perturbation. In some sense, assuming that interactions are not really strong, and so we can do perturbation theory in this term. So this will be our strategy. But before that, let me say a few words about the properties of this Lagrangian. Namely, it retains the gauge symmetry of, it is still gauge invariant. Can add a gradient term to A. So here I changed notation a little bit, so I changed sign and then introduced this 1 over A term, but this doesn't matter too much. There's still a gradient, so the
the first term of the Lagrangian will be invariant. Now, it's this term will not be invariant, okay, because A shifts by some gradient, so this term will also will change. However, this change is compensated by the change of this term if we simultaneously transform psi by a phase transformation. I don't know if it's immediately clear that this is a symmetry of the Lagrangian. Can everyone see that this the Lagrangian doesn't change when you transform this? Yes?
I mean, change is not.
Where? Alpha? No, this is just alpha. I guess it's not immediately clear.
Is that the transformation that gives you the invariant current?
Yes, in the. So that's true. So this is the same transformation from which we derive the current in theory without this term.
In the electric current, although alpha was not a function of space time, here it is.
That's right, yes. That's an important difference.
That would be a subset of this.
Yes.
Shouldn't the current somehow be related to the charges? Like, there's a term there that has electrons and positrons, and there's a term there that has a current density.
Yeah, so this is included here. So this zero's component of it is the charge density for the constant point.
So these two terms are components of the same thing?
These two terms?
Sorry, maybe I'm confused. There's, like, the... Never mind.
Okay, so this... Okay, the logic behind this is, so this was just an illustration that if we couple charge density to potential, then obviously the Lagrangian is complex as that one. Lorentz invariant generalization is this term, and this describes also magnetic interactions between currents and magnetic fields. And then, okay, J is... Psi bar gamma mu psi, 4 electrons. And so we just substitute this for the psi, and then we get this Lagrangian. So as simple as that. Now, okay, so this is it's a simple exercise, of course, to check this, the invariance of the Lagrangian. Okay, and I ran out of time, so I will explain how. So there is a way to write down the Lagrangian in such a way that it becomes immediately clear, but that I'll do on the next lecture. So thank you. That's it for today.